we hear about it a lot. When an NFL or an NHL player gets concussions or even dies from diseases like CTE, which is believed to be caused by repeated hits to the head. But contact sports are only one cause of traumatic brain injuries. My next guest points to a stat that every 8 seconds in America, someone suffers a brain injury from an incident that probably won't make headlines. Falling in the house, a collision, maybe while riding on a bike or in a car accident. And finding a cure for those injuries is hard. There is a brain injury research lab at Hennepin County Medical Center that's studying better ways to detect and treat brain injuries. The head of that lab is Dr. Uzma Samadani, who joins me now. Thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As we talk, I'd love to know what questions you have, maybe some experience here, you want to ask a professional for sure about this. Give us a call, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1, and please don't call or text if you're driving. Now, the reason we wanted to bring you on, Doctor, I mean, you've been doing this for many years, but there was a recent announcement that has to do with professional football leagues, and, you know, you're gets into the debate about football and sports and things like that. I actually wanted to start with part of the conversation that you've been part of. Your son plays football.
That's correct.
In high school, and you've said that kids should be allowed to play. Just walk us through your thinking. You're a researcher on brain injuries, and you've come to this conclusion. Just talk about that for a minute.
Well, basically, the decision to allow my son to play football was made after rigorous analysis of the data looking at risk-benefit. So obviously, there's a risk from anything that you can do. The single greatest risk for children and brain injury is from driving in a car or riding in a car. Basically, especially with texting and driving, there are 11 American teenagers every day who sustain a fatal brain injury from riding in a car or driving in a car. So that's your highest risk. Your other risks for brain injury in childhood are from suicide, are from homicide, and those are obviously things that our suicide's definitely on the rise, particularly among girls. So those are obviously things that you can prevent and control by looking at risk factors. But ultimately, sports as a cause of death is relatively low. As a cause of brain injury, it's still about 40 to 60% of cases, depending on how you look at the epidemiology. But there are benefits to sports, too. So the risks of brain injury from sport are very quantifiable, mm-hmm. and the benefits from sport are also very quantifiable. Basically, for every single parent, I advise them, you have to sort of do the risk-benefit analysis for your individual child. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I can talk you through the decision depending on how long sure. you want me to take on this.
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting note to make there that you, especially in childhood, I mean, you're talking about risk at different stages in life, too, and we'll talk about the NFL in a moment, but that You reminded me of the stat about how people are afraid to fly, but you're at a bigger risk of dying on the way to the airport, right?
Correct.
On the car. You're at a risk. There is a risk of head injury if you play football, but that you're actually at a higher risk driving to and from practice.
Correct.
I've never heard it phrased that way, so I'm lingering on that for a moment. And so you went then with your own son and to say, well, look, he can play and do all of that.
I think the thing that most people are worried about now is not so much death, but they're worried about the subconcussive hits. They're not even worried as much about the big concussions as they are about the little ones and the cumulative impact of multiple exposures. But if you look at the data on this, there have been three really good peer-reviewed studies that have been published over the years looking at long-term cognitive function in football players, and all of them support the idea that playing sports, playing football in childhood, particularly at the high school level, does not have deleterious consequences, even at the age all the way out to 72, according to a paper that just got published in JAMA Neurology last summer. So that study was of male football players in Wisconsin who graduated from high school in 1957. They were followed all the way to the age of 72. They did not have a higher risk for dementia, for depression, for alcohol abuse, and for a number of other outcome measures. They were more likely to be participating in sports at age 35. They had lower risk of cardiovascular disease. So ultimately, it's about risk-benefit. Mm. You know, the benefits of sports: decreased high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, sedentary lifestyle, 13 different types of cancer, cardiovascular disease. All of these things are very, very real. And if your child ultimately has a predilection for football or a proclivity for this type of activity, then you have to look at risk-benefit.
And yet, last November, I'm reading an article from the Star Trib, two doctors here in Minnesota actually called for the removal of football from public schools because of the rate of concussions among football players. When the doctors are disagreeing about it, I'm at a loss for what I should do then if I have a kid who might be playing football. You're saying that in your risk assessment, you're letting your son play. You have other doctors saying different things. And here we are just listening in some ways to the doctors argue it out. And I don't really know what to do. What would you say to that?
Well, the two doctors who did think that football should be banned are both bioethicists. And neither of them, I think, has a deep and rigorous understanding of the brain injury literature. If you go to the neurotrauma meetings and if you really understand this literature, you'd be surprised at how many people permit their own children to play. For example, you know, the head of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Concussion Center, Tina Master, has sons who played hockey. There are other parents I know at Boston Children's, the head of their concussion center is a huge sports advocate. It's pretty much accepted in the traumatic brain injury community that, yes, there is a risk for brain injury with contact sports, but the benefits of sport vastly outweigh the risks. And most of the literature that's been done that demonstrates the contrary has limitations such as no controls or strong ascertainment bias. And that makes it very, very difficult to interpret because often what happens is that literature gets disproportionate press compared to the well-controlled epidemiologic studies.
Dr. Uzma Samadani is with me from Hennepin County Medical Center, heads the Brain Injury Research Lab, which has been going on here. How long has that been?
Well, I moved here in 2015, but Galen Roxwald has been doing spectacular brain injury research for 40 years. He recently retired, but he still does research. He retired clinically.
1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 if you have a question for Dr. Samadani here. And the interesting thing, again, I see from what you've written about and what I've seen press coverage of you is that you talk about the risk in high school and then college, but then when you get to the NFL, which none of us do, like 0.1% of us do, there is that the whole ball game changes if you do get to the NFL. Is that right?
Well, I think ultimately the risk benefit profile is different for every child, even at the high school level. And then obviously that changes at the college level and it changes still further at the NFL level. Nobody could possibly ever fault an NFL player for saying that they want to stop playing due to risk, because obviously the risks are very, very significant there when you've got people who are extremely large and extremely athletic and physical, and there are potentially great forces. I think what's happened in the NFL is that risk-benefit ratio has been affected by the changes that the NFL has made in rules. And obviously, there's plenty of room for improvement there. Yeah. But ultimately, I think that even at the high school level, some people are going to make a decision that maybe their child shouldn't be allowed to play. For example, I let my child play because I have talked to his coach, I've talked to his trainer, and I've talked to him, and I've made it very clear to my son that if he ever has any slight suspicion that he might have a concussion, I'm going to check him out and I'm going to make sure that he's okay. But if you don't have that rapport with your child, with their coach, with their trainer, then the risks are different.
Rules, including the kickoff, starts from further down the field, which
correct
largely means more touchbacks, which largely means you have fewer people catching the ball on the 5-yard line and then getting just pummeled by someone who's had 50 yards to run at you. I mean, that is a big change that I've seen in the NFL, at least.
Correct.
What is it now, as we have the Super Bowl coming next year, and that's part of what you're trying to do? You've done research, and I want to make it clear here, we're not, the lab at HCMC doesn't just talk about football, doesn't just study football injuries. All brain injuries are in your purview, from a fall, from a car accident. But you are, with the Super Bowl coming, interested in looking at NFL players and their siblings. Talk about that.
Correct. So we have a study looking at the chronic effects of neurotrauma. And the component of the chronic effects of neurotrauma that has received the most media attention is CTE. But I would caution people that that is only one aspect of the potential chronic effects of brain injury. We are interested in all the treatable aspects of brain injury as well. So, for example, someone may have autonomic dysfunction. Someone may have vestibular dysfunction, where they have dizziness or feel off balance. Someone may have ocular motor dysfunction, where their eyes aren't coordinated in their movements. And we have research very clearly looking at specifically that problem. There are specific things. There are endocrinopathies. So there's hormonal dysfunction that can result from brain injury. And we're interested in teasing that out. Our main interest is, number one, in helping to figure out how we can help these people, how we can make the chronic effects of neurotrauma better. We're less focused on how we can, for example, diagnose CTE in living people, because CTE can be asymptomatic in half of the people who have it, at least half. So it's a little unclear that focusing on CTE is the right thing to do, when really what we need to do is treat the symptomatic components of the chronic effects of neurotrauma. So that's goal number one.
But CTE is so scary.
Well, we'll talk about that in just a moment. That goal number one is to figure out how we can treat the chronic effects of neurotrauma that are treatable. And then goal number two is to better understand susceptibility. So we know certain things. We know, for example, that 21% of orthopedic surgery department chairs played college football. So they not only played high school football at a high level, but then they went on and played college football. Of these, 46% report having had one or more concussions, which is substantively higher than the general population. Yet these people are orthopedic surgery department chairs. So they have resilience. We know that there are about 10 to 12 genes involved in resilience. What we're interested in doing is looking at football players and their siblings. So, for example, we had recently a Green Bay Packer in the lab who had played in the Packers probably about 20 or 30 years ago with the Packers, and he has two brothers, one older, one younger. We want to measure the cognitive function in this particular player, his neuropsych function, and we want to compare it to his brothers so that we understand what is the role of genes versus football. And then once we figure out which genes make people particularly susceptible to the chronic effects of trauma, then we can exploit those functions and figure out how to treat those people to prevent those problems. And so a classic example would be, for example, we know that the protein brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, is elevated in people who have higher resilience. And so perhaps there are therapeutics that could be targeted along that pathway.
And so when you're saying the word resilience, you're actually at this point using a clinical term. You're not just talking about the more socially used use of the word resilience. I have resilience. You're actually getting very clinical there when you use that word.
Yes. What I mean is how quickly you can recover. So when you have two people who have the exact same brain injury, one may recover faster than another because they have enzymes in their brain that turn over neurotransmitters faster than the other person. And there's not a thing in the world that they can do to control that. This is something innate in their genetics. And obviously, if you can manipulate gene expression, you know, if you can get down to the molecular level and change things, you can level the playing field. And everybody gets to recover from brain injury rapidly.
I doubt you'll ever get this scenario, but it sounds like you're saying if Sam Bradford and Teddy Bridgewater both retire having had their bell rung the same number of times, having had the same number of head injury, you know, hits to the head.
Correct.
But only one of them actually develops some of these symptoms. You're saying it's because one of those players' family genes may have a role. Do we know for sure that his family genes will have a role, or is that literally what you're researching?
That's what we're testing. We know that there are at least 10 or 12 genes that have been implicated in these pathways, in these recovery pathways. And the goal is to be able to very specifically identify them in players and their siblings and then figure out what makes people susceptible. Because if we can do that, then we can exploit the function of these genes and treat people. And that's why ultimately we're having this fundraiser right before the Super Bowl called Superbrain 2018, because we want to understand what makes a quote-unquote superbrain. Yeah. We want to understand what makes people resilient to brain injury and how we can take advantage of that knowledge to improve care and treatment for brain injury in the future.
And just on that note, you're having this event. Ben Utecht, a former Gopher player, and he played with Indianapolis. He's got a Super Bowl ring, was with you at a recent press event. But my understanding is that this is happening with an organization called the NFL Alumni Association. It's alums of the NFL. Is the NFL at all helping you with this? Because we've heard, especially with what's happening out with CTE and Boston University, a mixed review on how interested the NFL itself is in being a part of this.
Well, let me start by saying I'm not at liberty to understand what the NFL thinks about anything. I'm not part of their head, neck, and spine committee. Mm-hmm. I do know Alan Sills, who is the chief medical officer for the NFL, and I have tremendous respect for him. I think he's a good guy, but I don't actually have discussions with the NFL regarding their policies, and I can't speak on their behalf in any way, shape, or form. All that said, I will say this about CTE, because I had promised you I would get back to it. So CTE is a very, very interesting condition. It was originally described in 1928. Harrison Martland, who's a pathologist from New Jersey, who noticed it in boxers, wrote a paper in JAMA and published the findings of CTE. And it was called at that time dementia pugilistica. It didn't get renamed CTE until about the 1960s, when this group in Queen Square in England, a group of neurologists, very rigorously described both the clinical findings, you know, what symptoms people had, as well as the pathology. And then what happened in the 2000s was, in the United States, two separate groups came out with papers suggesting that CTE was found in American football players. And the problem was the pathology was not the same as had been originally described in the 50s and 60s. And so there was some controversy over it. And so in 2015, the NIH sponsored a conference to define CTE. Mm-hmm. And when they did that, they set a sort of list of diagnostic criteria that would meet, you know, sort of qualifications specifications for CTE so that any pathologist could make the diagnosis. And the problem was is that then people went back to their brain banks, you know, and the Queen Square Brain Bank has thousands of brains. It's literally the oldest brain bank in the world. And they looked at it and they found that CTE was present in 11.8% of healthy, normal people. And additional studies have now been performed. Some studies suggest that it could be present in as high as 26% of healthy, normal people. That was a study that was published out of Canada last year. So we don't know, we don't fully understand the implications of CTE. We know that it's associated with contact sports. We know that approximately half of people have symptoms, but there's no definite clinical correlate. What we need to understand is why those half of people have symptoms and if they actually have other reasons that cause them to have symptoms. So, for example, we know that consumption of opiates, and a lot of NFL players have taken painkillers such as opiates in the past, can increase your risk for having or developing CTE.
Wow.
And so it's a very complicated condition.
So does that mean, and again, it sounds like we don't know this. I'm asking an unknown question, but you're saying it's possible that all of these cases of NFL players getting CTE is more because of all the painkillers they took than all of the hits they had?
Well, that's what we want to understand.
So we just don't know that.
We want to understand the role of, number one, genetics, number two, comorbidities such as psychiatric history or other substances that are imbibed during, you know, high school, college, NFL training, and then finally the impact of the brain injuries. And so obviously, having brain injury is never, ever good for you. You're never going to convince anybody of any potential benefit from brain injury. There isn't one. And the cumulative effects of multiple brain injuries are even worse. So obviously there's that. And that's the biggest consideration by far. But certainly being exposed to opiates and painkillers and other substances and having psychiatric comorbidities probably doesn't benefit. And what we need to understand is, What does this mean to the risk for your average 12-year-old?
Right.
You know, for your kid who in 7th or 8th grade says to his parents, you know what, I really want to play hockey, or I really want to play football.
Or soccer, we're hearing more about soccer.
Or, you know, especially girls. Girls are more likely to have prolonged incidence, duration, and severity of concussion symptoms. So, you know, what does this mean for them? If we understand what component is due to genetics, what component is due to comorbid consumption of substances, and what component is due to brain injury, then hopefully we'll be able to make better educated decisions for our children about whether or not they should be permitted to play and how much we need to continue to strive to protect them from other influences.
One other note on CTE, that movie that came out a few years ago called Concussion.
Correct.
Which had to do about the birth of finding it in NFL players here.
Yeah.
I've always thought that was the wrong name because you don't need to have sustained concussions to have CTE. Is that right?
That's absolutely.
It's the wrong name for that movie.
That's absolutely true. So one of the papers that got published about CTE basically showed that having played contact sports increases your risk substantively, regardless of whether or not you've actually had a brain injury. And so that's obviously one of the concerns. But consuming opiates, independent of playing sports, also increases your risk.
Wow.
So CTE is a very complicated condition. And that's why when I talk about chronic effects of neurotrauma, I think about CTE as only a subcomponent of what we're dealing with.
So do you get people now coming into the lab because we have this opioid crisis in America? You know, we talk about other ways you get brain injuries, and you're studying from here to there, whether you fell in the house and hit your head, whether you were riding your bike and you hit a tree, whether you're in a car crash. Do you actually get people who walk in off the street who've had none of those but were addicted to heroin or painkillers and they have brain injury? Or no? Or do you have to have some kind of blunt force to qualify as a traumatic brain injury?
Well, you don't have to have a blunt force to have a brain injury because you can have a rapid flexion extension of your neck. So, for example, you can be in a car accident and never hit the windshield and still have a brain injury just because the front-back motion, that rapid acceleration-deceleration, can cause a shear of neurons.
Because the brain moves inside your skull and smashes against your head, right?
Exactly. And then you can also see this with blast. So, for example, I know some of you guys have probably followed the news from Cuba, where
yes,
recently they had sonic wave or blast overpressure exposures. And some of these were sub-acoustic. So the victims didn't hear anything. They never felt or heard anything, but they have brain injury. And this is very, very classic for blast overpressure waves. You see this also with natural gas explosions, with other types of pressure waves that can travel, and you can get brain injury from that and never know it.
Hmm.
That's, I think, probably one of the more terrifying ways by which brain injury can be inflicted on someone.
Yeah, I'm going to sleep well tonight, doctor. Thanks so much for that. But what is it that you, but that's the goal, right? I mean, yes, we want to know all this stuff about CTE. We want to know about all these things with football players and the like, but you're also talking about literally being able to diagnose for someone who maybe was near an explosion once in their life or had a jolt in a car but never felt anything. You're literally trying to be able to say, actually, did you know you have a brain injury and this person may not know it? Is that right? I mean, that's what
Absolutely.
You're going for.
So the major, you know, we talked about football. Football is not at all a focus of my lab or my research.
Right.
Actually, the major focus of my lab and my research is to prevent, classify, and treat brain injury, with classify being the biggest component of that. So when I say classify brain injury, what my lab does is it is developing and testing objective measures for brain injury. So we are using serum markers, we are using eye tracking, and we are using radiographic measures to quantitate the extent of brain injury, regardless of whether or not someone has a direct blow to the head.
Let's take some calls here now as well. Dr. Uzma Samadani is with me from HCMC. I think a lot of these will be sports-related, but again, just take note there that a lot of our work is not sports-related. It's the entire world of brain injuries. Here's the Center for Disease Control estimate. 1.7 million people visit the emergency room, are hospitalized, or die each year from traumatic brain injury. Let's go to John, who's on the phone in Minneapolis. Thanks for waiting, John. Go ahead with your question.
As a therapist for people that have brain injury, I've been having some difficulties with clients that are breaking the law and having to go into the correctional system. What do you think we can do as professionals to engage our lawmakers in making sure that people that get charged with crimes who have brain injuries receive the same kind of consideration that one would receive if they were addicted to opioids?
Thanks for the question. Is that something you think about, Doctor?
Yes, this is definitely something that we think about. And in my opinion, this is one of the biggest problems that we have with treatment of brain injury in our society. Because especially, quote unquote, mild traumatic brain injury or concussion is something that you can't really objectively quantitate with current methods. Nobody sees it. Nobody knows that it's there. And then you send the patient, you know, wherever you send them. You can send them home from the hospital. You send them, you know, home from the emergency room. You send them to prison. You send them anywhere. There's no treatment because there's no objective sort of quantification of what the problem is. And it's worst among prisoners, obviously, because we don't have the resources for them. There was an article I tweet. My Twitter's at Dr. Somadhani. There was an article that was published in the New York Times, I think it was an editorial, about how the healthcare system is failing people with mild traumatic brain injury or concussion because it does not have the resources available to them for the treatment that they need. I think that this will change as we develop objective measures for brain injury, mm-hmm. but it's certainly a very, very real problem that you have pointed out very aptly. And I hope, it is my hope, that in the future, people will take brain injury as seriously as they take, for example, a heart attack.
Well, but that sounds like you're talking about a test. We need to develop a test to see if you have a brain injury. The way I'm thinking from the law enforcement side, we can test when we pull you over or arrest you if you're drunk.
Correct.
And we know that. And so the options range. They can ticket you. They can put you in what we used to call the drunk tank. You know, you just let them sleep it off. I mean, there's so many options on what to do with someone when you have tested and you know they're drunk.
Right.
You're talking about potentially having a test, blood or otherwise, in the police station or on the roadside that could test for brain injury? Do I have that right?
Correct. If you can identify brain injury, then you know that it's a problem and you know you need to treat it.
And so you respond to that call and you finish that call as a police officer differently.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's less police and more ambulance at this point because mm-hmm. most people, if they have a trauma, they're usually calling a medical professional or they're being seen in the emergency room. Currently, what happens to those patients is they come in, they get a physical exam, maybe they get a CAT scan. The CAT scan may or may not show anything. If it doesn't show anything, they're sent home or they're sent back to jail or they're sent back to prison or they're sent, you know, wherever they're going to go. And there's not really a clear and dedicated system in place for offering them further care because it's not really clear. Nobody really knows what's wrong with them. They say it's a concussion, but it's not particularly helpful to them, that diagnosis. And there are people who in the Twin Cities who are doing a fabulous job of identifying these patients and treating them, but it tends to be patients who come from high socioeconomic status groups of society that are getting treated. And that's why the statistics show that having a high socioeconomic status or education level predisposes to a much better outcome after brain injury because people are getting resources at the top but not at the bottom.
So you really think we're heading for the day where a simple test, maybe blood or otherwise, can show whether I have a brain injury the way a simple test can show whether I'm drunk or whether my blood is B positive? I mean, we're heading for that day?
Yes, I strongly believe that. And I'll be 100% honest with you. I mean, I will disclose that my lab works on this and this is what we do.
Yeah.
But eye tracking, I think, has phenomenal potential for this because you can't fake it. So either your eyes move together and are tightly coordinated in their movements or they don't. And when they don't, there's obviously a problem and it's something that you can actually trace where in the brain the dysfunction's occurring based on how the eye movements are disconnected or reduced. So, for example, if you have swelling in a certain part of your brain near certain nerve roots, you're going to see decreased function of those nerve roots. And it's actually quite powerful. And it's an amazing test because it's non-invasive and it gives you a direct measure of central nervous system function.
As I understand it, with these eye tracking tests, you put on a piece of video, which may be a part of the movie Shrek. I read that somewhere. Shrek has made it into the repertoire. So you show Shrek on the screen. I'm hooked up in a way that you can see my eyes and I watch the movie.
Correct.
And then you measure how my eyes move. And if they move in a certain way, you're finding more and more that will be the sign that I have a brain injury.
Correct. So the way the technology works is we measure the position of your pupils over time. So you're just sitting there watching either Disney cartoons or a music video. We use a lot of, Shakira or Kanan. Canine. I can't even say it. We use football highlights, you know, basically whatever content someone wants to watch. Mm-hmm. We have them watch TV for about 220 seconds, and we measure the position of their pupils. And then we compare the movements from the left eye to the right eye, and we look for discrepancies. And when we look at where those discrepancies occur, we can trace that back to where in the brain disruption might be present. And so, you know, in a few years, instead of someone coming into the emergency room and saying, oh, you know, you've had a concussion, go home and you'll be fine, we can actually say, well, it looks like you have right parietal edema.
And it's this part of the brain that's hit.
Yeah, we're going to treat it with, you know, X therapeutic, and we should be able to retrack you in a few days and see if you're better.
How do you know if I'm taking that test, especially in a hospital, if my eyes are wandering or not doing what they're supposed to be doing because I have a brain injury or because, just to use the example, I'm drunk?
So alcohol affects eye movements in different ways. Alcohol causes nystagmus. It causes other specific problems. And we've looked at that. We've taken normal healthy controls and we've had them get eye tracked, and then we've had allowed them to drink and then re-eye tracked them. And what we find is that it affects eye movements in ways very different from trauma. Trauma affects eye movements in ways that are very, very unique. And there are multiple metrics depending on where in your brain the injury occurred and the nature of that injury. But it definitely affects your eye movements in ways that are very different from, say, alcohol or narcotics.
Let's go back to the phones here with Dr. Uzma Samadani from HCMC. I'm learning a lot. I hope you are as well. Teresa's on the phone here in Iowa. Nope, she's not there. So let's go to Carrie in Shoreview. Hi, Carrie. Go right ahead.
Hello. I was wondering, in the venues of football, I was talking to a neurologist who wondered if the volume of the crowd, including the speakers inside the helmets of the quarterback and defensive player at such a loud volume, might be an issue, or the cumulative effects of season ticket holders or people who just attend a lot of loud venues.
Yeah, remember how the Metrodome, right? That was the home court advantage, is that you could make that building so loud. Is that a thing?
I believe it is. And the problem is I don't have data to support my hypothesis, but I've been at games and I've been on the sideline and it is deafeningly loud. And I wear noise-canceling headphones and I still come out of the games feeling a little bit shaken. I can't imagine what it's like for the players to play game after game, season after season, without any sort of ear protection and with, as you mentioned, helmets that could potentially even exacerbate the problem. Yeah. So I believe that being exposed to that chronic, you could call it a sonic wave, you know, because it's a hearing blast, can't be good for your brain. You know, I don't have data to support that, but I would suspect that my hypothesis would be that it would probably not be beneficial.
Tom here asks on Twitter, he says, I had a severe concussion because I fell on the ice in 2007-ish. I forgot to mention ice falls. Of course, in Minnesota, a lot of people fall on the ice. Am I a candidate for working with your lab? I think you're looking for subjects. Is that right?
Correct. We are looking for people who've sustained neurotrauma in the past. We are more or less specifically focused on people who have siblings. So if he has a brother around, you know, the same generation with similar genetics and psychosocial past history, then, you know, that would be very beneficial. So then we can compare the two. A single isolated concussion is pretty unlikely to result in significant chronic effects. Only about 3-5% of single isolated concussions will have permanent consequence.
He does says he seems to think he is still feeling consequences, but you're saying that that's actually rare if it's just one time.
But, you know, if he is feeling consequences, then it might be interesting to study him. So we'd be happy to have him call the lab. And our number is 612-873-7190.
7190. I will tweet that out as well, and I will tweet out the link to your lab as well, Tom. So I'll return that tweet. Dan is on the phone here in Chanhassen. Hi, Dan. What's your question for Dr. Samadani?
Hello. I was wondering if a child at a very young age had a bad fall and received a concussion, which wasn't diagnosed as a concussion, but it was a very bad fall, would it show up on adult testing if you develop a test?
This is a great question. And the reality is that it totally depends. You can't answer that question with a solid yes, no, because it depends on how the child has recovered. So what we see, generally speaking, in the population is that it's a function of genetics and it's a function of environment. So many people who have very high cognitive reserve, excellent neurologic function, won't have consequences from a single brain injury. Other people who are more susceptible for genetic reasons or for other reasons, you know, maybe they don't have access to support after the initial injury, and so therefore they are dealing with many more stressors in their life, and that impedes their recovery. Those people may have more consequences. So it's impossible to answer that question as a single yes, no, but it's certainly something that we could, you know, we could look at.
Another question here from Steve, who's in Shakopee. Hi, Steve. What do you want to know here today?
I'm a 66-year-old male. I've had three concussions in the last 6 years, two before and one after an ischemic stroke 16 months ago. I'm wondering what testing the doctor would recommend for me.
Yeah, this is something that you could, for example, come into the HCMC Traumatic Brain Injury Outpatient Center and get assessed for. The reason that you may have had concussions after the initial injury is that you may have had an increased susceptibility. And that increased susceptibility may have been because your balance is off or because your vision is off or something is not quite right that makes you at higher risk for hitting your head for some reason. We do know that after a single brain injury, your risk for a second brain injury goes up eightfold compared to the general population. And that's probably due to increased susceptibility from subclinical malfunction. So what that means is that something's not quite right. Either your balance or your perception or your visual spatial awareness or your ocular motor function, and that's increasing your risk.
So, and we've seen that with football players too, right? If you had the first, the second, third, and fourth are quote unquote easier to get. I mean, that's a headline in football, but you're saying that's a headline in life too. If you get the one concussion, you could get the second easier.
That's absolutely correct. And there are a number of places in the Twin Cities that are doing visual motor rehab specifically for recovery after concussion. There are places in Edina, there's one in Burnsville that does a lot of the NHL teams. There are other places that look specifically at trying to rehab people who've had either a concussion or other injury and need that.
I've always wondered how people like you who are in research like yours don't just sit at home wrapped in bubble tape, not leaving the house.
Well, yeah, if you follow my Twitter feed, I'm constantly tweeting about the benefits of leaving the house, actually.
Well, that's true. There's hazards there as well.
I mean, when you look at the risks of a sedentary lifestyle, they're huge. It's high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, dementia, stroke. You know, it goes on and on. There are 13 different types of cancer that are very closely linked to being overweight and sitting at home, sedentary lifestyle. So, you know, the risks of doing nothing are actually quite great and very well known, whereas the risk of consequences of brain injury associated with sport they're less well understood, but they're definitely smaller.
They're smaller, but they're magnified more.
By the media.
You're welcome.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, this is very interesting, and I hope you'll come back. We had a lot of calls we didn't get to. I think there's more to talk about, so this has been great. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Uzma Samadani with me from Hennepin County Medical Center. I'll tweet out her Twitter handle so you can follow her, and she can tell you all the joys of leaving the house every day. This is NPR News.